This week on the Best of Flashpoints, Kevin Pina reports from the ground in Port-au-Prince, and civil rights lawyer Walter Riley talks about the historic and current struggle of the Haitian people. Also, Anand Gopal talks about U.S. secret prison sites in Afghanistan, and we hear from a leader in the popular nonviolent resistance struggle in Palestine as Israel continues to arrest, torture, and imprison civil disobedience activists across the West Bank. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We continue our drumbeat reporting on the situation on the ground in Haiti, as the death toll now has risen to over 200,000, with more than a million Haitians homeless and on the run. Meanwhile, the United Nations is announcing that the new hero, the person they're counting on to put the rescue effort together and rebuild Haiti, is former U.S. President Bill Clinton. Joining us to talk about the ongoing nightmare and suffering in Haiti is Walter Riley. He's a human rights attorney and chair of the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. They are working day and night to save lives in Haiti. Walter Riley was in Haiti during the earthquake. I'm sure you've heard some of what he had to say, but we think he's a very important person and want to keep the dialogue going with him. And of course, also joining us on the ground in Haiti is our special Flashpoints correspondent for Haiti, Kevin Pina. Kevin, welcome back.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going very well. How are you doing? Tell us what you did today.
Well, today was actually a day of reflection for me, although I did make it down to two of the camps today. I've mostly been doing a lot of phone calls and interviews, trying to get a handle on the politics behind all of this, particularly as it relates to Haiti on the ground. There are a lot of political questions that remain unanswered. For example, the parliamentary and national elections that were going to be held on February the 28th are not going to happen. They've been postponed indefinitely, as we presume will be the next presidential elections, which were scheduled for later this year. So what that means exactly, we don't know, but certainly if I were to judge the pulse of the population and Preval's popularity based on the interviews I took today, at an all-time low.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints. Kevin, maybe adjust yourself a little bit. You're fading just slightly. Now, we're hearing about over 200,000 dead now, Kevin, and perhaps a million or more people on the run. What can you tell us? Are those figures that you find believable?
Well, I mean, I you know, it's really hard to be able to estimate. There are so many, many people who've been left homeless by this crisis. Certainly, the number of families have increased as the camps themselves have begun to increase. But remember, there was also a sizable homeless population before the earthquake. Families were already forced into small dwellings, having to sleep in shifts. So it's really hard to tell if some of those people haven't also melded with these camps. On the other hand, I think the figure might be a little bit high, but here in the capital, I think they're giving the figure of about 800,000, as I heard on most of the radio stations today, as far as the number of homeless. But regardless of the number, it's too many. Regardless of whatever that number is, there's still not enough adequate food, water, there's not enough adequate shelter. Daily, the fears of diseases are rising, as I've said before. That hasn't changed. I think that every day that people grow more malnourished and more dehydrated, the larger the problem is going to become. In the meantime, people have not sat on their hands either. I mean, they're going out, and there have been a few spontaneous demonstrations demanding that the aid be distributed, rallying against what they consider to be the corruption of the networks through which Preval originally attempted to distribute aid, namely the mayoral offices and what are called the ASEC and CASEC offices, which are sort of local communal offices, about 30 all told, throughout the capital. And at the same time, people seem to be digging in for the long term. They're not just going to wait under sheets when the rain starts falling. They've begun, as I said before, bringing construction materials. They're actually constructing entire cities now of wood and corrugated tin roofs. They're having thriving businesses. They're building little businesses. There's an electronic shop in one of these tent cities. There's a barber shop in another one of them. Commerce is going on. People are resilient, and it looks as if they're digging in for the long haul, as I said, and that's going to present a real problem for the Parole administration when they go to relocate these people. People are not going to want to go. It's going to be interesting to see how this is going to be handled.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, that's Kevin Pina on the ground in Haiti. And Kevin, your colleague is here in the studio, Walter Riley. Welcome, Walter. You have a question for Kevin.
Thank you. How are you, Kevin?
Good to hear you. Kevin, could you tell us something about the mobilizations, if there are, regarding Aristide? I saw some on television where people had photographs of the president calling for his return. What's going on right there, and what do you know about Family Lavalas at this point, their mobilizations?
Well, it seems as if the mobilizations that we saw yesterday and the day before were spontaneous. These are people who've just grown fed up with the situation. There's two demands that are really clear. One is a return of Aristide, but the other one is down with the corruption. And of course, that corruption to them is intimately linked with the Preval administration and his handling of this crisis. As far as the official organs of Femi Lavalas, I have not heard a press conference from them. We were expecting that there was going to be one this week. It's just Thursday, so it's possible that tomorrow we might hear something from them. I do understand that former President Aristide did give another message that was transmitted over the radio here again last week. It seemed to be well received by the population, and I think that if you were to take a pulse of most of the people, particularly in the camps, those who are homeless, that overwhelmingly they support his return.
Are the people on the ground really aware that the elections are postponed, and what's their response, do you know, in terms of the leaders or some of these organizations in these camps?
Well, I get the feeling that they weren't terribly concerned about the elections in the first place. So I don't think that they're missing one way or another whether or not they've been postponed, because I don't think that most of them really had planned on participating, even if they were to be held. Of course, on the radios here in the Capitol, the news has been reported that the UN and the CEP have announced that there can't be elections. But I think that's pretty obvious. Any sane person would know that you couldn't possibly hold elections under these conditions, but I'm not all that sure about the sanity of Haiti CEP, and I'm not sure that a lot of people here in Haiti are either, given some of their earlier decisions. Now, whether or not when they do reorganize elections, that the decisions that they made before, such as banning the Femi Lavalas party, Haiti's most popular political party, from those elections again, I'm not sure how that's all going to be worked out. And certainly, I think that Preval, when his term expires, that's going to raise a large constitutional question. There's never been an example of a Haitian president's term being extended because of a natural disaster. Normally, what would happen, according to the Constitution, is he would be forced to step down, and the senior member of the Supreme Court would then assume the office of the presidency. How that's going to be worked out, whether or not the international community will actually play by the rules of Haiti's Constitution, which we know they've not had a great track record of that in the past, it's yet to be seen.
We know they didn't do that in terms of the elections last time. Family Lavalas boycotted the elections, and very few people participated. When the court decided last fall that Family Lavalas had to participate in the elections, the judge was fired that made that decision, and Family Lavalas banned again. I know they were calling for banning or opposing participation in the election, and I believe that's still their position at this time. Without Family Lavalas, there's no democratic election. Is that what people are saying?
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear, but you also have to remember that, Preval was pretty Machiavellian in his approach to those last elections. By banning Lavalas, it also opened some deep rifts and divisions between those in Lavalas who wanted to participate in the elections, and that sort of created five competing parties from within the Lavalas family, if you will, and those who were opposed to it. Of course, the vast majority, I believe, of the people on the ground, the poor who continue to support Aristide's return, Corn and the Lavalas movement would not have gone to vote in those elections either. But I think that there were some who believed that it was the only choice that they had in order to get back into the political arena. But the truth is that that has been wiped away. The entire political terrain, the entire political landscape has been changed and altered forever. And so those same divisions and those same questions that face Lavalas no longer exist. And so now, of course, I think it's a period of rebuilding. It's a period of them bridging some of the disagreements that they may have had in the past, of reunifying and coming together. I think a lot of those questions may be being answered today behind closed doors.
I'm going to come back to the politics in one moment, but I want to get to the back to the human rights side of this. And both of you work with the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. Walter, you've been working nonstop trying to figure out ways to get aid to the people. You were there. You saw the devastation firsthand. Tell us about the struggle you're having and other agencies are having trying to get the necessary aid down so that people such as Kevin and others can help to get it around. Tell us about your concerns and what that struggle looks like.
The struggle, of course, is still to get the aid on the ground to the people. We are sending aid. We're sending people over with aid. Kevin, of course, went with some aid. But there are people on the ground with aid at the airport and stockpiles in various places, and there is a real need to try and get that released. I was on the telephone two Saturdays ago with members from the State Department who said they were going to make it possible for people on the ground to get aid by going to the aid stations and going to the various places where the area, where the supplies are stockpiled. Well, that never happened. State Department was not responsive. I know that Kevin tried to make some contacts with folks, too, to try and get aid released. I don't believe he had any successes in getting the agencies to release any aid. This is part of the militarization of the process of gaining control of Haiti, and that's what we're dealing with, the control of Haiti and the Haiti population. They don't want the popular participation in government and nor popular participation in the recovery effort. So the grassroots organizations that are organizing right there in the in front of the palace and the other tent cities are not being responded to, from what we can tell. Some things are getting out, but very little effort to rely upon the infrastructure of the community. Human infrastructure that exists there is powerful and palpable, would make a big difference. But that would be to rely upon and build the masses of people. There's no desire to do that because you can't do that and maintain maximized profits in this manner that Haiti has suffered from all these years.
And in terms of your concerns at this point, looking down just a little bit at the rainy season, and you can respond to this too, Kevin, after Walter, but we've been talking about this, and this could be the second wave of tragedy when the rain starts to fall.
Well, I know from just telephone calls that people on the ground are worried about that. I believe that's true from all the people that are here that understand the nature of this kind of tragedy. The rains are going to come and people will be outside suffering from the illnesses that they already have, the wounds that they have, injuries from the earthquake, the pre-existing conditions because the medical system didn't exist before that served the people, and the human waste from body movements, from the waste that comes from just this kind of tragedy is going to wreak havoc with the people. That is the second wave or another wave of human tragedy caused by humans in Haiti. More dying, more suffering.
Kevin, you want to respond to that?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. Mostly, it's, you know, the young children are really hit and struck by this. I mean, sleeping in the dirt and, you know, sleeping in such close quarters jammed together with no real sanitation. We're seeing a lot of skin diseases, treatable, but a lot of them, everything from scabies to ringworm, which are passing through the camps. Most of the children have colds or the flu, have fevers. It's not a very good situation. It's certainly not how people want to live, but in some areas, as I said, they're actually beginning to build cities and makeshift cities in order to try to make life better, but some of them can do that. Some of them don't have the resources to do that, so it's sort of uneven now as you go from camp to camp, seeing different levels of building construction and improvement of their lot. But overall, this is not tenable. The thing that strikes me most is is you go into those cities and you see how you see how much they're working together to improve their lives, even under these very, very difficult situations. And what they're really surrounded with now is a growing presence of the United States military. They are now in the streets, much larger.
Kevin? All right, we're going to have to... We'll get Kevin back in a moment. Coming back to what you were saying, talking about the State Department, we have been talking, and we were talking before air, about the fact that Bill Clinton is now going to be counted on as the new hero who's going to come in and save Haiti. And I was saying to you, Walter, that... we have President Aristide, who has demonstrated an extraordinary relationship with his people, who came up through the poor, who knows what it means to try and organize a rescue mission and to work at the human rights level. Clinton versus Aristide, your response?
The real problem, it's an outrage. It is an outrage that Clinton is the favorite person to go into Haiti, supported by the international community of governments and aid agencies, as opposed to John Bertrand Aristide, who is popular, who has the ability to lead people in a unified effort for recovery, demonstrated legal and administrative ability in Haiti. He was removed totally because it was necessary for the elite and their ties in Canada, U.S. and France to maximize their profits in the sewing industries. But it boggles the mind to think that President Obama is assigning Bill Clinton, the man who refused to give Aristide the kind of support that could help him build a police force that would protect people. The man who insisted that Aristide had to sell off his industries in order to satisfy the international monetary programs. The president who decided that Aristide was not going to get the funding support to make it possible for his regime to be successful. And the same policies that Bush carried forward, the same alliances in Haiti that Clinton had, Bush had, in terms of supporting the elite families that have control over the industries, over the agriculture, over the profit-making, many of them offshore people, that we have to live with Clinton and his pronouncements regarding Haiti is a denial of the dignity of the people of Haiti, a denial of the sense of independence that people can have, and a denial of the sense, we know, of the resilience of people of Haiti to build and rebuild that country. Clinton doesn't have that sense, but Aristide is a person that all of us have to be aware of and should call upon. We had to get into some of these discussions we've had in the past here in this community about President Aristide. There is absolutely no reason that anybody here should resist Aristide being returned to the country. He hasn't said he wants to be president. He wants to return to participate in the growth, regrowth, and rebuilding of the country. He is the person who can do that. I think that in the coming weeks and months, we're going to see the movement swell in Haiti for the ending of the present government and bringing back President Aristide.
And just the ultimate slap in the face, and it's incomprehensible to me, Walter, but the idea that Obama would also task George Bush, recent President George Bush, it's almost like he seized a moment for...
A symbolic slap in the face. It's a symbolic to all of us that know what's going on in Haiti, that have looked at Haiti, that even would have some uncertainties about where the future is. But we know that George Bush is the president that engineered the removal of Aristide, the kidnapping of President Aristide in 2004.
It's extraordinary. And, you know, it seems like, oh, this is Obama being bipartisan, but in a cruel and vicious way
on the backs of Haitians and on the backs of everybody in the African diaspora, on the backs of all of us beyond the African diaspora that understand the fight for liberty, the fight for democracy. This fight for democracy is a worldwide fight, and it reaches into all our corners and of our minds and our living spaces and our philosophical approaches to the way we work with each other. and our political organization. This struggle right now for us in this area is centered in Haiti. This is a tremendous struggle that has to occur to ensure that we support the struggle, the people in Haiti who are fighting for democracy. And that is, the popular movement has to be supported.
And the diaspora, let's talk about, there are huge communities, Haitian community in the Bay Area, in New York City, of course. People to this day don't know if their friends, their relatives, their colleagues lived or died, and they're not having a lot of help communicating. Could you talk about that struggle?
Well, that's true. They're not getting the administrative efforts, the bureaucracy that exists in the World Health Organizations, the U.S. government, the embassies, to help them find their loved ones that are missing in Haiti. There was a tremendous effort by my family and friends, including you and people here in this station movement, to find me and my family when we were missing in Haiti for those few days. And I thank everybody for that. I'm really grateful for that. It's touching. But the State Department didn't come looking for us. And when we went to the State Department, they didn't even know that we were in existence. So they hadn't done anything, even though our names were on the list. That's the way it is with many other people. I'm just reading an article by Peter Howard. That's posted on the Family Lava Loss website. And if you need to look at it, it's Haiti, HAYTI.net. That's the Family Lava Loss. You can find them on the internet. And this article discusses the role of the aid agencies and what they were doing to try and find people. A lot of time was spent to dig people out of the UN site. And that's necessary. Those are human beings. They need to be dug out. But there were plenty of other people. They didn't go to the other sites on the first day, the second day, or the third day. A lot of effort is being spent to get those people out of the Montana Hotel. That's the hotel where most of the foreigners stay. That's the hotel that we can see a lot of Americans would have been there and were there, and Americans lost life. And it's tragic, the families that are still needing to find the bodies of their family members, loved ones at the Montana Hotel. But the effort that's spent there, which is in Peytonville, is not commensurate with the effort they're spending in other places in Peytonville, where there are black people, where there are Haitians, Haitian nationals, where there are Haitian Americans. There are a lot of Americans still missing. Most of those Americans are not white Americans. Many of them are Haitian Americans. And there is not the same effort and concentration on finding those people. What's the basis of that? It's part of the history of our society. It's part of the history of the way we have dealt with things from time immemorial. We remember New Orleans. We remember Katrina. We remember many other times. And right now, we see some of these same reflections in the way our country has responded to Haiti.
This idea of 15,000 or 20,000 troops on the ground in what appears to be more of an occupation than a rescue mission, now with Bill Clinton, and he's talking about the international monetary community. He was in Davos pleading to use Haiti as an example to the world of how to rebuild a country that's been living in squalor for decades. It doesn't seem it seems like what they're going to build is a U.S. embassy in Haiti, maybe a listening post for the region, maybe a way of jumping off and attacking Venezuela, maybe attacking Cuba because they've been so supportive.
Well, it is one of the largest embassies in the world. I think it's fourth or fifth or something like that.
In Haiti.
In Haiti, the largest. I mean, this small country.
Poorest country, largest embassy.
And the amount of military support there. We have the Marines moved out and the UN forces moved in for occupation, for security, militarizations, and stability. The elite in Haiti and the owners of the factories and their ties, diplomatic ties here, political ties in the United States, call for militarization and security. Security, security. Not humanitarian aid. Before the earthquake, it was not building Haiti. It was security. Their concern is for security. And what is that security? To maintain their facilities for maximizing profits. You know, the International Monetary Fund has decided that the wages that people make there and the amount of money that they live on is about 44 pennies. 44 pennies a day. Now, we often talk about a dollar a day or less, $2 being the considered minimum wage in Haiti. Lots of discussions about what it might be. 44 cents a day is absolutely ridiculous as a wage, as an income for people. Their livelihoods cannot be sustained under those circumstances. Their ability to find some moment of repose where they enjoy the stars, where they enjoy the poetry, is much more difficult under these circumstances. Their ability to commune with nature, to commune with each other, to commune with their faith becomes a lot more difficult under those circumstances. And that's what life is about. The love of humanity requires us to fight for something more for Haiti, for ourselves, because we are much lesser if we allow this to happen so close to us. People who we can identify with, who we know. It is unthinkable that this can go on. And this rebuilding of Haiti is going to require us to have a lot more vigilance in our work, in our political approach, in our understanding of Haiti. We can't allow this to go in this manner. I mean, we need to kick down doors if necessary. We can't allow it. We can't allow it to maintain our own humanity. No more than we could allow slavery to exist in our midst, you know, in our lifetime. We wouldn't if we know it. Well, listen, that's what's happening. When we have a government and a military that ensures that profits are maximized to the extent that the sewing industry, the production industry in Haiti, is made up of people who can't even have a decent living, people who were going to work just because there was food at work and they would take the food home, that weren't getting paid. They took food home because they needed it at home. They didn't have it otherwise. That's what people have described Haiti was before the earthquake for many of these people. This is what was what President Aristide was fighting against. He had a readiness plan that was destroyed. His medical facility was destroyed. We talk about the need for doctors. When the U.S. Marines went in, what was one of the initial things they did was they kicked the doctors out of the Aristide Hospital.
And, they kicked the doctors out of the Aristide Hospital.
And made it a military barracks. And occupied it and didn't allow them to come back. Now, these were doctors who were being trained by Cuba, doctors who were desperately needed in Haiti because Cuba obviously gives more doctors to the world than any other medical facility or any other medical training than WHO or anyone else. They were training doctors in Haiti, and they were looking for, and Haiti was looking for doctors from any place, anybody who could help them. Aristide was looking for help from the U.S. He had hoped that he could get help here. He had lots of allies here that he was relying upon, in both in the social justice movement and in other places. But he didn't get it in government. He didn't get it in the political circles. And he didn't get it in those circles of folks, U.S., France, and Canada, who wanted to maintain power, who wanted to maintain those factories so they could keep the sewing industry, the production industry, at the lowest possible wages. Slave conditions that existed in our lifetime. They exist in many other places, too. There are terrible conditions in other parts of the world. This is right here at our doorsteps. An hour and a half from Miami.
And how long? How are we in a month into this now?
Into this earthquake? Yes, January.
An hour and a half away, a month into it.
People are still not getting goods. People are not getting food. People are not getting water from those aid agencies. People are not getting medical supplies. You know, you hear it every day. We talk to people. You heard from Kevin. You heard from Christina, Dr. Chavez, who we were able to get over there. We're going to hear it more. People are not getting it. And we have to send money for people to buy water in Haiti when there is water sitting at airports. There's a U.S. ship sitting offshore that makes water. Another thing is there are a lot of U.S. ships sitting offshore to ensure that Haitians don't get in the water and come to the United States.
Right, no asylum for them.
Yes.
And no escape. They push them back into the burning fire, as Aristide once said.
Absolutely. And all Aristide is saying, as he says, as it is on his on the website from Family Law Loss, they're trying to move from poverty to dignified, from poverty to some dignity. And that's all they're looking for. Yeah, from the terrible and horrible conditions, they want dignified poverty. This is this young priest, priest who had a sense of the need for some change in the condition of his people, and as he started to organize around that, he was attacked.
Standing at the door, and I wanna come in. no.
Oh, standing at the door, and I wanna come in.
Oh, where are the keys to the kingdom?
You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints, a roundup of our most powerful segments of the week. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio in Berkeley. I'm Dennis Bernstein, and this is your daily investigative news magazine. Well, if you thought kidnapping and abusive behavior, maybe torture, was a thing of the past under the Obama administration, you may be sadly mistaken. According to an investigative report coming out of The Nation and TomDispatch.com, the U.S. military controls secret prisons across Afghanistan, known to insiders as field detention sites. That's sweet. According to the report, there are special U.S. military units operating throughout the countryside. The units conduct early morning raids, kidnapping terrorist suspects. Oftentimes very weak information on that, and sometimes killing innocent victims, or who knows who the victims are here. Maybe they're all victims of the raid. Afghan independent human rights commissions have confirmed many of these complaints that appear in the story. And we're joined now by Anand Gopal. Gopal writes for The Nation, Christian Science Monitor, other media outlets. Anand Gopal, it's good to have you with us on Flashpoints.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's certainly not a pleasant subject, so maybe you should just give us the thumbnail sketch of the operation of these secret little prisons across the country. I guess they call them field detention sites.
That's right. These sites, there's nine of them that we know of, and they're on U.S. military bases that are strewn across the country. And these are small holding cells, typically used for interrogations. And so U.S. forces will detain a suspect on a raid, bring the suspect to these detention sites, keep them there for 4 or 5 days, and if they deem them to be a threat, then they'll move them on to the big prison of Bagram. And it's either en route or at these detention sites that we still see a lot of allegations of abuse.
Now, you talk about early morning raids. You report that the U.S. troops, at least one family that was raided, said the troops came in. Most of them were heavily tattooed and bearded, came at 3 a.m. Well, tell us the story of Majula Karar.
Well, Mr. Karar is he's a government employee. He's a spokesman for the for one of the government ministries. And one night, U.S. Special Forces came into his home. They were looking for one of his cousins. But in the course of doing that, they came across two other family members and shot them dead in the night. Then went through the house, ransacked the house, and threw dishes on the ground and clothes, and found the person they were looking for, and took him along with one other person off to one of these detention sites on the military base. And the reason they did this is that they were acting on a tip that this person was related to Al-Qaeda. They took him to a detention site, released one of the family members, but kept this one suspect. And since that point, the family has no idea what's happened to him. They haven't heard from him, and they've tried to appeal to other government officials and U.S. authorities, but for all intents and purposes, he's simply vanished.
Now, let's just take a closer look at this. You're saying that U.S. troops broke into this house at 3 a.m., killed a couple of people, kidnapped a couple of people, let one go, and nobody knows where the other one is. This is the U.S. military.
This is the U.S. military. Specifically, it's the Special Forces, Special Operations Forces.
Special Operations Forces, and I guess supposedly they're engaged in winning hearts and minds. How do we confirm that this happened?
Well, I interviewed a number of other people there, such as government officials, who corroborated the story. Government officials came the day after the raid and went to the scene, interviewed a lot of people, and corroborated it, as well as photographs taken from the scene that match the description of the event given to me by the family members.
Now, we heard a lot about Abu Ghraib and about Bagram in Afghanistan and some pretty severe things going on in terms of kidnapping and torture. Now this is happening under the Obama administration. Is this a project of the Obama administration? Are these field detention sites something new?
No, they're not new. This has been going on since 2001, since our invasion there. These detention sites have been there. Now, not all of them. Some of them are newer, some of them are older. But the practice of counterterrorism, of going into people's homes and taking suspects and locking them away and interrogating them in these sites and then sending them on to Bagram, that's a practice that's not new. It's been going on for the duration of the war.
Now, you talk about 24 detainees. Tell us about a few of the people who you have managed to confirm their stories based on independent human rights groups and government people. Tell us some of the other people. Help us keep put a human face on what's going on here.
Well, sure. One of the most striking cases of the 24 that I dealt with. There was one gentleman who was apprehended and taken to one of the detention sites, and over the course of 5 or 6 days, systematically tortured. He was forced to swallow more than 12 bottles worth of water. He was at one point made to kneel on a metal rod, and while there's his hands were held from above with a pulley, and the rod was rolled across his shin, damaging his bones there. Other times he was chained from the wall, other times hung upside down. Then finally taken from this detention site and sent to Bagram, where he spent 4 or 5 months, and then released, very unceremoniously released, with a letter saying that they had gotten the wrong man and that the authorities were sorry about it.
Now, who did the torturing? And were there U.S. officials present? Were the U.S. officials doing the torture? Is this a CIA operation? Who was in charge?
These are the U.S. Special Forces, again, that are doing, and Special Forces here mean Navy SEALs, Green Berets, and Army Rangers, and the like. So the people who are doing the torturing were in uniform. They're interrogators and they're in uniform, which means that they most likely weren't CIA. But given the pattern of other detentions across the country, it means most likely they're Special Operations Forces.
So you're saying that this is an ongoing program of the U.S. military, and that torture is being, kidnappings, killings, and torture is being carried out at these various field detention sites, and that there is, I guess, an ongoing program of torture by the U.S. government across Afghanistan. Do I have this right?
Oh, that's right. It's changed a little bit in the last few years, where in the early years, most of the torture is happening in Bagram, which is the main prison in the country. But in recent years, all of it shifted away either to these smaller detention sites or even away from there and to the point of capture. A lot of the worst abuses happen when the people are being captured by the troops and taken to the detention sites. And most of the people I've interviewed allege that the abuse took place during that time period.
So the abuse happens right after the kidnapping?
Yeah, that's usually the point where the abuse happens.
And that's when they will maybe even decide to kill some people and take some hostages alive.
Well, there's been allegations of people who've been detained who've turned up dead. I detail a couple in the story. Again, there's no way...
Tell us a couple of those. Tell us one of those stories, please.
Well, there was one case in which 9 people were detained in a house raid. And over the course of the next couple of days, they were interrogated in separate groups. One group, about 4 or 5 of them, were released. And then the other group was taken away and not seen or heard from again. But then 2 people from that group, their bodies were found a few days later. Their bodies, their hands were in handcuffs, and they were found about a mile away from the U.S. base. So the U.S. military denies that they've been involved in killing these people, but this is firmly believed by the locals in the area.
Anybody know where the handcuffs were made?
They are plastic handcuffs of the type that's typically used by U.S. forces.
by U.S. forces. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Incredibly disturbing story by Anand Gopal that appears, information from his research appears in Nation, TomDispatch.com. And we are really confused, I guess, as we listen and as we listen to you speak. There doesn't seem to be at any level an end to the U.S. government's pattern of torture, kidnapping, and abuse under Obama. So this program simply continued apace and perhaps even expanded to make up for the people who weren't being held at Bagram.
Well, that's right. And as I mentioned, it's continued under Obama, but it has changed. And not even this predates, the change predates Obama from the last 2 years of the Bush administration, where there at one point Bagram was so notorious with or synonymous with torture and abuse, and I think it became pretty uncomfortable for the authorities for Bagram to have that association. So what we have seen is a shift away from using Bagram for the worst abuses and actually having them done in places where a lot of attention isn't a lot of attention on, for example, these small field sites.
And what? How can you evaluate the impact that this sort of alternative hearts and minds kidnapping policy is happening in terms of the U.S.'s declared mission on the ground?
Well, the U.S.'s declared mission on the ground is to protect the civilian population, and by doing so, win them over and weaken the insurgency. But if you talk to the civilian population, particularly the rural Pashtuns who live in those areas where the war is being fought, they say again and again that, yes, we do want to be protected, but often this means we want to be protected from both the night raids and detentions of the U.S. military and the Taliban, not just be protected from the Taliban. So it's really helped to inculcate a lot of fear and hatred towards the coalition presence.
So this is not doing anybody much good, and it's creating more anguish and anger against U.S. forces who are on the ground now.
That's right. It's undermining the very objective that the U.S. forces are trying to achieve.
And for you, I mean, when you do the research on this story and when you investigate, what are some of the questions we missed? What are the concerns that you think need to be considered in the context of a story like this?
Well, you know, the biggest thing to understand with this sort of story is that I spent a lot of time with the U.S. troops to try to get the other side and get a sense of why this is happening. And what I found again and again was that the U.S. military isn't able to sort of separate this aspect of what they do, sort of the counterterrorism, with the rest of what they do. And, you know, if you think about it, it's not too surprising because this is what militaries do. They're trained to go into areas and find people and kill them. And to ask them to do otherwise is actually, you know, it's difficult. And so, and I put this question to a lot of Afghans and said, well, you know, soldiers say that they're in an area where they're being fired at and they don't know who to trust, and therefore they just round people up and take them away. And the answer I usually get is, well, if that's the case, if the only way they can come to our area is by detaining us and doing this, then we don't want them to come at all.
All right. I want to thank you very much, Anand Gopal. A very troubling story, a very important story about continuing U.S. kidnapping and torture by U.S. military forces in Afghanistan. We thank you for doing the hard work on this, and we're going to keep track of it as best as we can. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
You're listening to the best of Flashpoints, a roundup of our most powerful segments of the week. Stay tuned.
Come, you masters of war. You that build all the guns. You that build the death blades. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind deaths.
was your little toy. You put a gun in my hand, then you hide from my eyes, and you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our focus on the acceleration and intensification of arrests by Israeli forces of anti-apartheid activists in the occupied West Bank. In the village of Bila'in, one of the most high-profile villages with an organized nonviolent civil disobedience coalition, three more Palestinians were arrested earlier this morning as Israeli soldiers raided the village, declared it a closed military zone, and took Ibrahim Abed al-Fattah Bonat, Ashraf Abu Rahma, and journalist Hamda Abu Rahma. This comes on the heels of several months of regular and violent raids by the Israeli military on dozens of villages in the occupied West Bank, specifically targeting grassroots members of the growing popular struggle against the colonialist policies of the Israeli government, including the ongoing construction of the illegal separation wall and the settlement colonies. Meanwhile, in the occupied Gaza Strip, Israeli warplanes carried out six separate airstrikes on at least two targets in the southern areas last night. Three Palestinians were reportedly wounded and three others were reported missing shortly after the attacks, which targeted the already destroyed Yasser Arafat International Airport and a tunnel along the Gaza-Egypt border. Joining us to talk about the current situation inside Palestine is Mohammed Khatib. Mohammed is a leader in Bila'in's Popular Committee Against the Wall. He was arrested last Thursday by armed Israeli forces who broke into his home at 2 in the morning as he, his wife, and his young children were sleeping. He was arrested and thrown into detention. Last night, however, the military court admitted that they had no evidence to imprison him with and released him back to his family. Khatib was previously arrested last August with charges of incitement and stone throwing. The Israeli military alleged that Khatib was photographed throwing stones. Yet after 2 weeks in detention, a military judge ruled that the evidence against him was falsified since Khatib was out of the country at the time and ordered his release. Mohammed Khatib, thank you so much for being with us today on Flashpoints.
Okay, thank you.
It's good to have you with us, and it's good that you're out of detention again. One more time, the military had to release you because of that little detail of a lack of evidence to charge you with. Let's talk about what's happening right now in Bila'in and in dozens of villages across the West Bank and in East Jerusalem as well, as the military and the Israeli government seem to be intensifying the war against the popular nonviolent resistance movement. Can you talk about the kinds of actions you're seeing in your village and other villages that employ tactics of nonviolent civil disobedience and the reaction by the Israeli military right now?
As you know, and since 5 years we are doing nonviolent demonstration in my village Bila'in and also in other places like Nadin and Al-Masara. Since 2 years they are also doing, and now it's expanded to other places. Since last June, the Israeli forces follow a new tactic to stop this demonstration by following the arrestation and trying to arrest people because of their participation in the demonstrations. And since that time until now, dozens of Palestinian and activists being jailed, and they are using the military, system and the military courts to try to keep them. And you know the persecution, the military persecution, it says it in a clear way that we will keep anyone who's participating in jail. And we will try to keep him, and we will use the military court to do that. So they are trying to prevent us from participating in the demonstration and to try to stop this demonstration, which is nonviolent demonstration. That the goal of this demonstration is just only to keep continue that our resistance and our that we are against this war and this the confiscation of our land. So it's our right to demonstrate in this way, but the Israelis also want to take this right from us by connect that to a legal procedure to say that we are just only doing and implementing laws. And by the fact that they must, you know, this war and these settlements are illegal not only you know, it's illegal by the international law. So who's supposed to be arrested or to be judged and bring to court is the Israeli forces who are breaking the international law and doing these illegal things. So this is the situation that the Israelis are trying to stop these demonstrations after they failed by using the violence, by using the military and the weapons, and dozens also been killed by these different kinds of weapons, and now they are following this to stop the demonstration. But I don't think, and we believe, that we will succeed and we will manage to end this occupation.
That's the voice of Mohammed Khatib of Bil'in in the occupied West Bank. Mohammed, let's talk about how you were arrested and what you experienced while you were in detention. Tell us about what happened last week as you and your family were sleeping when the Israeli troops raided your home and confiscated documents, including your papers from Bil'in's legal procedures in the Israeli High Court. Why would they want those documents in particular, and why do you think they arrested you in this way?
You know, they arrested me because in the last 2 weeks there was a lot of high profile and focusing from the Israeli media about what's going on. So there was two reports and two articles in the main the Israeli main newspaper, Haaretz and Yedioth Ahronot, Ynet. So they spoke about the situation and what's going on and the Israeli behavior. And I was quoted there. So they came to arrest me under this reason that all the time they are using, which is the security reason, that they have the secret information that I am supporting and I am leading this demonstration, not only in Bilayn, but also in different places in the West Bank. So they came in the middle of the night, and it was the same day that my brother-in-law was released from jail after being 6 months, which was arrested with me in the first time. So you know, the time that he'd been arrested, that we were celebrating his get out from jail, they came to my home in the middle of the night, in the time that I was, with my family and my kids are sleeping, and they rushed to the home without, and they are... They wake all the family and take us out, and they start to search in the home, searching for papers, and they don't know what. They took me, and they keep me in a place until the morning, and then they took me to the officer jail. And there they start, investigation and asking questions about my position in the committee and what I'm doing and all these things. And they have nothing against me. It's just only a political arrestation and trying to make more another pressure on me, like to stop being part of this movement, which is non-violent movement and peaceful movement. But they don't want to see any kind of resistance to this occupation.
You're amongst a group of high-profile, well-known leaders of the popular struggle in the West Bank, along with Jamal Juma'a, Abdullah Abu Rahma, and Mohammed Othman of Stop the Wall campaign. You've been arrested, detained, released several times now, with the court unable to produce real evidence against you, of course. You know, and as you said, the real people who should be on trial here are the Israeli military and the government, who is keeping this occupation and the settler colonial project going. Jamal Juma'a says that now the military is changing tactics. They're going after the grassroots activists now, those who aren't really well known in the international circles who come from villages not on the international radar, trying to uproot the movement that way. What's your response to that?
I think he's right, and this is what the Israelis are all the time trying to do, and especially in last year, that it's especially after the Gaza war, we are seeing that there is more aggressive, and in the more aggressive way, they are trying to stop any kind of resistance, and also especially after now the BDS movement has become more strengthened in the world, and The popular resistance also on the ground is becoming expand and spread to other places. So with the support of the international solidarity movement in all over the world, and also after the Goldstone report, and now the Palestinians are also trying to implement the High Court, the International High Court opinion. So the Israelis think and start to realize and to know that by this way that they are losing their position and their strength to connect the Palestinian struggle to the terror. But by using the non-violent method and the struggle, it's strength the Palestinian fight, and more people are taking part and be part of the BDS movement, boycott and disinvestment and sanctioning against Israel, which is become more strong, and we start to see results from that, and especially what happened with Tzipi Livni, the Kadima's the ex foreign minister of Israel, which she was part of the war. So I think that this is the situation that we are achieving. It's true that it's small successful or small succeed, but we are in strong steps. It's true that it's short steps, but long and strong hope and future.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.